This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Economic growth makes rich countries. It also, at the dawn of the 21st century, raises a lot of questions about the impact of unending growth on the environment, on endless sprawl, on cultures thrown into the spin cycle of globalization. Bigfoot economist Benjamin Friedman says, get over it. Growth, he says, in a big, provocative new book, doesn't just float economic boats. It is vital to sustaining morality itself, to nurturing openness, tolerance, fairness, democracy. If that makes Greens see red, there's a zing for conservatives here, too. American growth today, he says, is so tilted to the rich that it doesn't count. Up next on Point, Benjamin Friedman on growth and the good society. Joining me now in the studio is Benjamin Friedman, professor of political economy at Harvard University and author of the new book, The Moral Consequences of Economic Growth. Liberal lion John Kenneth Galbraith calls it a major contribution to social well-being. Free market champion Jagdish Bhagwati calls it a tour de force. Professor Friedman, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Benjamin Friedman, here we are. If growth supports morality, what's this good thing? How do you see this good thing? What is it that it supports?
The concept of morality that I have in mind is the notion that Western thinking, ever since the Enlightenment of the 18th century, has regarded as the basis of a good society. I have in mind opportunity, the issue of whether the people who are allowed to get ahead are people other than just those whose parents and grandparents and great-grandparents were in the elites. I have in mind fairness across groups and also across individuals. I have in mind the strength of our democratic political institutions, and in many countries around the world, what's involved is not just strengthening democratic institutions that are already there, but creating democracies out of what are very different forms of governance. And finally, I have in mind notions of tolerance. In an American context, we would think, of course, about race relations, but I also have in mind religious prejudice. I have in mind attitudes toward immigrants. All of these features of how a society works are features that the Enlightenment thinkers of the 18th century thought were central to what makes a good society. They thought of them, these features, explicitly in moral terms, and I think we've done so ever since. That's what I think growth promotes.
You take us across a huge landscape here of Nazi Germany, its economic problems, and the emergence of fascism there, across the Great Depression in the United States and how the U.S. responded. A huge march through history and culture looking at the effect of economic growth. But it's absolutely fascinating. But why are you writing it now? Do you see economic growth as under attack?
I think there are two reasons, Tom. First, yes, around the world, people do fail, I believe, to understand what economic growth is about and why it matters. People understand, of course, the material advantages of economic growth. Everybody knows that. But over time, we've come to be more and more sensitive to drawbacks of the growth process, most obviously environmental degradation, which you mentioned a moment ago, to which we've appropriately come to attach a moral overtone. And as a result, lots of people think that evaluating economic growth is all about balancing benefits which are purely material against negatives that are purely moral. And a person thinks, well, if I'm somebody who emphasizes moral values more than material things, then I'm supposed to be against growth and I'm supposed to be opposed to policies that are likely to promote economic growth. The point of the book is that that's just wrong, that economic growth brings these very important moral benefits as well. And I think both we in the United States and also people in other countries where growth is a much more urgent matter than it is for us even, I think people will be more likely to find their countries on the way to genuine economic growth if they understand why growth is so important in the first place.
Give us your essential formula then. You know, growth has often been seen, that is, the sort of attaining wealth is another way of looking at it, in whatever degree, has often been seen as morally corrupting. You say economic growth is morally uplifting. What's the formula? What's the evidence you point to?
What I have in mind is people's having a sense of progress in their lives. People want to move forward. This is something that I think thinkers have understood for generations and centuries. In the book, I continually picture people asking questions that depend on the stage of the life cycle where they find themselves at the moment. For young adults, I picture people asking questions like, how is my career starting out compared to what my aunts and uncles enjoyed in their day? A little further along, people ask themselves, what's it like living in my house to the way my parents lived? A little further along, how am I providing for my children compared to what I remember growing up as a child in my parents' house?
And if it's better, I'm going to be a better person? I'm going to help create a better society?
Not in the explicit, self-conscious way that you describe it, but I think the point is that when people are experiencing a sense of forward progress in their own lives and in the lives of their families, then they are inclined to be less defensive about their posture with respect to other people, and it importantly includes people who are not like them.
And when they don't feel that sense of progress?
I think the sense of the balance of history shows that when the broad bulk of the population has the sense of not making progress, and even worse, you mentioned the Nazi German experience, when people have the sense of retreating in their material standard of living, that's the time when people adopt attitudes that are more rigid, more defensive, and society as a whole not only doesn't make any progress in these moral dimensions like openness and tolerance and democracy, all too often, as I show in one country after another and one time period after another throughout history, all too often that's precisely when societies go into a period of retrenchment and erosion and retreat. And of course, the Nazi German example is just the most extreme one, but there are many, many others as well, including some of our own experience in the United States.
Well, you say the United States is at risk of that, or even in the midst of something like that right now.
Many people think that the United States is experiencing economic growth today, and it's of course true that the total output, the GDP in our economy, is growing. That's
four
right.
4-point-something percent. This is a pretty strong, big economy growth.
What I mean by economic growth in the book and in my argument, and it's an important distinction to make, what I have in mind is that the broad cross-section of the population has a sense of moving forward. This is not a book about the very rich. It's also not a book about the very poor. What I have in mind is the broad cross-section of the population. And it's unfortunate but true that 2004 was the fifth consecutive year in which the median income, that's the income of the person right at the middle of the American income distribution, failed to keep pace with inflation. We don't have data yet for 2005, but it's a pretty good guess that 2005 was the sixth year in a row. Now, my book is not about business cycles. It's not about comparing today versus last year or the year before. But if we're now at 6 years in a row in which the middle of the American income distribution has been losing ground materially, this is starting to get in the direction of the kind of questions that I was asking before, of people saying, what are my children's prospects compared to my prospects as a young man or young woman?
The one period of history we've got to look at more closely, I think, is the Great Depression. It's got the great supportive example in Nazi Germany, economic woe, and fascism. The great, what seems to be a counterexample, would be the United States. We had the Great Depression, too. We didn't go fascist. We went the opposite direction. What do you make of that?
The first thing to say is that you're absolutely right. I agree entirely. The Great Depression experience is the one very important example in U.S. history that just doesn't support my argument at all.
And does that mean morality is rooted somewhere else? Not then in growth, but somewhere in the national culture?
I would again say that we are talking here about social science. We're not talking about physics, and we shouldn't look for hypotheses or relationships to be true everywhere and every time. The question is, what is the predominant tendency? What happens usually and most of the time? Because betting against what happens usually and most of the time turns out to be a bad idea. But I certainly don't back away from or try to hide the Great Depression experience. Indeed, I devote a whole chapter to it, and the title I put on that chapter is Great Depression, Great Exception, because it really was.
Why? Why didn't the United States turn, you know, we've had, Philip Roth last year writing a counter history, a fictional counter history of how it could have gone differently. Lindbergh wins and America turns right. Instead, it became very embracing, very open-armed social policies. Why?
I don't pretend to know, Tom, but there are several ideas worth considering. Some people point to the vigor and force of Roosevelt's own personality. Some people point to various things happening in the economy. If I had to guess, and it's really a guess, I would say that if a bad experience is bad enough, and this is whether it's economic, political, military, think of 9/11, for example, if a bad experience is bad enough that everybody feels threatened together. Remember, the Depression was very, very widespread. Off of the farms, we had nearly 50% of the American economy's labor force unemployed. Mm. We had stockbrokers. This was not just poor people. We had stockbrokers jumping out of windows. The guess that I make is that if something is so bad that people feel we're all threatened and the whole ship is going to go down and all of us are going to be on it, then instead of tugging apart the way people do in ordinary times of economic stagnation, then people decide they'd all better pick up an oar and row together. Mm. But let me repeat, this is only a guess, and I don't attempt to explain it. I regard the Depression as the great exception to my argument in American history, and I just have to accept it as that.
Paul is calling from Boston. Hi, Paul, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What do you think?
Republicans will say with great disdain that you cannot have economic growth and protect the environment and be socially conscious at the same time. I don't happen to believe that. But isn't it true that the environmental degradation we see at the expense of economic growth does indeed have a dollar value, not only in terms of how it affects our health, our quality of life, things like that? I'll take my answer off the air.
Paul, thanks for calling. Benjamin Friedman, everybody looks at that environmental tab out there. Can you have it? Can you have it all?
Well, Paul is absolutely right. The cost of the environment is not just aesthetic. The cost of the environment is concrete, and one can put a dollar value on it. I suppose the thing I would point out, and this is an argument that I make at some length, greater length in the book, is that those costs are much greater today in low-income countries than in high-income countries. I'm not a traveler in much of the developing world, but I can tell Paul that the worst pollution I've ever seen and experienced in my life is in Delhi, India.
But the United States is the greatest contributor to greenhouse gases.
Now, greenhouse gases is a very different matter, Tom. But let me finish first on the kind of pollution that Paul is addressing, because I think his point is important. Places like Delhi or virtually anywhere around India. Another example is in Beijing. Mm-hmm. Think about all of the people in Beijing sitting in the world's worst traffic jams. They do not pay $1,000 a car to put catalytic converters on their automobiles because the standard of living in China doesn't make it sensible to do that.
But the fear has been if they grow to an American standard of living, they'll absolutely overwhelm the global environment. If every Chinese family has two cars, even with their catalytic converters, so how does that fit in your argument?
And the technology gets better. 80% of the world's exposure to particulates in the air comes from, guess what? Families cooking over indoor open fires.
So if you've got a kind of Al Gore argument here, you can...
And why are they doing that? Mm-hmm. Are they doing that because they don't prefer stoves? Of course not. They can't afford stoves in the countries I'm talking about. Now, let me address the greenhouse gas problem, because I think you're right on target there. I think this is the most difficult matter of all. for two reasons. One, the technology is very difficult. And second, because the greenhouse gas problem operates at a global level, it's not called global warming for nothing, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. It operates at a global level, and that means that the only prospect to solve it is some form of legitimately global set of institutions, which we lack at the moment.
But and isn't growth as we know it the engine for that warming? I mean, are we into a different era? Are the stakes different? You're pro-growth for morality, but what if we don't disentangle growth from that very warming, that pollution?
And I believe that with the right institutions, we will. Think about the way technology has gone on. Here in Boston, if we were having this conversation 150 years ago, 1855, we would have talked about how all of the nice people down in Nantucket and New Bedford were about to run out of whales to catch, and therefore we would run out of illumination for our houses because there would be no whale oil.
Lucky us, we found petroleum, but now we've got a planet that's too hot.
Exactly so, and I think whether it's solar energy, whether it's fusion energy, mm-hmm. incidentally, even on the greenhouse gas front, the current cost of capturing CO2, carbon dioxide, at the smokestack mm-hmm. and rendering it into a form in which it's able to be buried would add somewhere between 30% and 50% to everybody's utility bill. I'm guessing nobody wants to pay that. But the important point is that if that's the cost of the technology in 2005, you know that technology is going to be cheaper in 2010, and it's going to be cheaper still in 2020. And I would be optimistic that, to repeat, with the right global institutions, which we lack at the moment, we will be able to harness that improving technology, even for global warming, which is the hardest environmental problem of all.
So social policy, governing policy, very important. We've got to turn to that. But maybe Andrew will help take us there. He's calling from Greenville, South Carolina. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. You know, everything you're discussing there, to me, is morality. Economic morality should mean everybody has a good life. I think in this country, and even more so around the world, we have the rich keep getting richer, and the poor never go away. And unless we develop some kind of socialism or at least a social policy that enables the poor to get out of the mud and the rich maybe to step down a notch, then everybody would have the same economic reality. And whether we do that, you know, with social government or socialism is kind of a dirty word in the United States. We have to address that problem, or, you know, I don't think trickle-down economics and robust capitalism is ever going to do that. It just keeps the status quo.
Andrew, we've got it, and thank you for your call. Benjamin Friedman, you hear the pushback. What about social policy, its role here? Socialism, Andrew raises.
I think we shouldn't stick on socialism because centrally planned economies have been tried around the world and have failed around the world, and that experiment has been run. But Andrew's point is really, I think, very much on target. The way I would put it is this. If we are in favor of economic growth because it will lead to a fairer, more open, more mobile society, then of course it makes no sense to pursue economic growth through policies that undermine fairness and mobility and democracy. Mm-hmm. And if we were in the unfortunate situation in which there were no policies that we could find that would promote economic growth and at the very least be consistent with fairness and tolerance and democracy, then that would be a pretty big pickle.
So what's our variance right now by Benjamin Friedman's lights?
But my part of the burden of what I do in the book, and here I'm referring explicitly to the United States, is to argue that there are plenty of policies that we could adopt if we wanted to do it that would simultaneously promote economic growth and make the society more mobile, more open, more fair.
Such as? Compare them to what we're doing now. What would you do instead?
To take just one example, think about Project Head Start and other early intervention programs for students, young children in so-called at-risk families. We know that these programs are effective in getting people to finish high school, to go on to college. We know that these programs are effective in enabling people to move on to be productive members of the labor force in later years, and therefore we know these programs will help the economy over time to achieve economic growth.
Tax policy, how are we doing on that front?
And just to stick on Project Head Start for the moment, it's obvious that those policies make for a fairer, more even distribution of opportunity in the society. How about tax policy? Tax policy matters principally today because our government's budget deficit is absorbing roughly three-fourths of all of the net saving that American families and American businesses do. And that means that saving isn't available to invest in productive equipment that would allow workers to be more productive and therefore earn a higher wage.
But President Bush says something different. He says if we have these tax cuts, we'll have people who will have the cash in their pocket to invest.
Well, President Bush is free to write his book, and I've, with all due respect, written my book. And I suspect that my book is different from what President Bush would write if he were to write his. In my book, I call for narrowing the federal deficit, if not eliminating the federal deficit, through a variety of means, one of which would be to have a rollback of the tax reduction that applied to the very richest citizens. I would draw some income cutoff, and it doesn't really matter very much for this purpose precisely what the dollar figure is, and then to allow people below that income cutoff to keep the benefit of the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts, but to roll it back for people who are above that cutoff.
Benjamin Friedman, we've just got a minute left here. Your final thoughts on where we stand now. How do you see the American moral standing, and what's the direction it's headed in by your analysis here?
No country is ever so rich that it can think that its basic fundamental moral values are not at risk. And I think the most central lesson of the book that I've written is that whenever a society, even one as rich as ours, goes through a period of economic stagnation, by which I mean that the broad cross-section of the population isn't getting ahead, then our values are at risk, our democracy is at risk, our fairness is at risk, our tolerance is at risk. And this is why I think the issue is so important today for Americans. We want to return our economy to one that provides economic improvement for the bulk of our citizens, which they're not seeing today. And we want that not just so that everybody can eat more and live in a bigger house and maybe dress better and drive a bigger car. That's not what it's about. The message of the book is that what it's about is our fundamental values in terms of tolerance and fairness and democracy. I think that's worth pressing for.
Pro-growth, spread it around, and be good. Benjamin Friedman, professor of political economy at Harvard, author of the new book, The Moral Consequences of Economic Growth. Professor Friedman, thank you for being with us today.
I've enjoyed the conversation enormously. Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.